might. Ecclesiastes chapter 2. A few things we want to say before we jump in. I'm doing the opposite thing that I did last week. Last week I didn't have enough to say, and this week I probably have too much to say. So we're going to try as best we can actually to get through the whole of chapter 2 today. A few things we want to review, maybe clarify before we jump in, is that one, just remembering and clarifying our programmatic question. Chapter 1, verse 3, the question that Kohelet is trying to answer: what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? The Hebrew word for gain is yitron. He's trying to figure out what he can get out of the deal. I was perhaps a little bit more clarification on this, or another illustration of this, because as we go through our lives, these biblical truths and realities tend to be illustrated all around us. So I was watching a video this week, a video of Shark Tank on YouTube. I don't know if you've heard of it or not, but essentially Shark Tank is where there's a panel of multimillionaires, and they listen to entrepreneurs who come in and give their pitch on why they'd like an investment in their business from these multimillionaires in exchange for some equity in their company, generally is how it goes. So the question really that all of these multimillionaires are at the end of the day asking is, what's in it for me? What will I get back after I put something in? Right? That's going to dictate whether or not they give someone an offer, is if they think they'll be able to personally get back more than they put into it. That's the question that Kohelet is asking. If I keep putting in, if I keep investing into this life, work, toil, pleasure, wisdom, whatever, what can I get out of it? Now, what if the answer came back to all of these multimillionaires on the panel? Death. At the end of the day, death is all you're going to get out of it. You can put in all the money that you want. You can put in all the time that you want. And you can even get out as much money as you want. But at the end of the day, you die. Your stuff stays and you go. And at that point, you have no more say in what happens with your stuff or with life under the sun. As an investor, if I'm seeking to get more out of it than that, then that fact, that truth is inordinately frustrating. Now, even if I know it and embrace it, it still is frustrating, but at least I understand what's going on, right? So that's one thing I wanted to clarify, is perhaps another illustration of the question that Kohelet's asking. The other thing I wanted to do is just touch briefly on the idea of wisdom. Okay, so this came up last week and it didn't really have a good answer. And I hope to a little bit better, at least today, address the idea of wisdom. So if you turn back with me to 1 Kings chapter 3, I want to look at perhaps the source of Solomon's wisdom. 1 Kings chapter 3, this is, I realized that it had been a long time since I went back and read the historical account of Solomon. You know, Solomon asks for wisdom, God's pleased and gives him wisdom. But I kind of want to go back to that and see if there was more insight as to what Solomon was actually asking for when he asked for wisdom. Okay, so in verse 9, Solomon makes his request and he says, "Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people?" And it pleased the Lord that Solomon had asked this. And God said to him, "Because you have asked this and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your word. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before you and none like you shall arise after you." So the idea of wisdom here, at least as Solomon was requesting and God granted to him, was the ability to discern between right and wrong. That's wisdom. To know how to live rightly or wrong. As we go throughout this world, we have this sort of plus minus idea of like what's good and what's bad, what's right and what's wrong. Okay, so now take this concept back to Satan in the garden. Okay, we have Adam and Eve there, and Satan comes to them. Well, actually, let's just go back there. Genesis chapter 3. Genesis chapter 3, verse 5. Satan makes his promise. The serpent makes his promise. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like God, knowing what? Good and evil, right and wrong. Satan promised them that wisdom would make them like God. And this ability to discern right and wrong would make them like God. Now, did it? No, not as he promised. Instead, and here's the big idea that we've got to catch about wisdom, especially in Ecclesiastes, is that wisdom was only capable of reminding man of his limitations. Wisdom actually only brought to him the ability to understand that there are things beyond his comprehension. It brought him to see failings, to be able to see right and wrong, but not be able to fix it. That makes sense? So wisdom allows us to be able to see the right and wrong. It's almost like, say, as an illustration, maybe somebody comes to you and says, you know what? I know the American government really well, and I can show you everything about it. I can show you everything that's wrong with it. I can show you everything that's good about it. So come with me, and we go on a journey, right? We're going to go through the White House. We're going to talk to politicians, and he's going to point out everything about what's good and bad about American policy and politics. And then he says, but you actually can't do anything to fix it. You just get to know about it. There's frustration there, right? It's almost better, like Solomon says last week, in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Sometimes you just don't want to know. Sometimes it's easier not to know because it's vexing to know and not be able to make straight what is crooked, right? So that's at least a little bit more, and this text that we go through today, we'll dive in the second section a little bit more on wisdom as well, but hopefully that starts to get gears turning in the direction we want to go with wisdom. So there's not, as we think about that, is there right and wrong wisdom? No, there is wisdom, which is the ability to discern right and wrong. There is just genuine godly wisdom or no wisdom at all, okay? So Qohelet sets out with his heart as his kind of exploration partner, right, to test and observe with wisdom the significance of man's toil under the sun and what man can get back based on his investment. Okay, here we go into chapter 2. Let's read verses 1 through 3. I've already done some of the highlighting on the screen based on things we've already talked about. Okay, so we'll highlight some new things today. But if you so wanted to, like, this is kind of what my journal is looking like, is just underlining, highlighting throughout the whole book these same themes so that they pop out of the text as we look through and read them, okay? Verses 1 through 3. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven the few days of their life. Okay, there's a few things that we want to point out here. One is our theme for this first section, which is pleasure. He says he's going to test his heart with pleasure. Okay, so we have it mentioned a few times here, twice here, and then later on in verse 10, we have it mentioned two times as well. Okay, so this is kind of his first test, is will pleasure give me a return on my investment? And this idea of pleasure, lest we immediately jump to assuming, I mean, yes, there's a sense in which what Solomon is talking about is somewhat hedonistic, like just a pursuit of what feels good. But this word pleasure can mean much more than that. It doesn't necessarily mean that. In fact, later on, it's used in the same book as a good thing. It's used as joy, right? It's pleasure, it's joy, it's enjoyment. So he's pursuing enjoyment. But yes, it could also be things like delight or joy. It's not necessarily like this overwhelmingly worldly or sensual or hedonistic thing. It's a little bit implied here in this section, but that's not what the word necessarily means. So he says, okay, I'm starting in this journey. And look, I say to of laughter, it's pointless. And of pleasure, what good is it? Right, what is it profiting me? And so then he begins this exploration. He searches with his heart how to cheer his body with wine. His heart still guiding him with wisdom, how to lay hold on folly. So Solomon is not devoting himself to pleasure without reservation, right? He still wants to approach it with wisdom, with an understanding of what's right and wrong. So he maintains a little bit of this level of mental objectivity. Okay, he's not abandoned wisdom, and yet he wants to test everything, right? Like, you say wine brings pleasure, let's try it out, right? I want to find out. You say this is foolish, let me see if it's foolish. He wants to go kind of on this journey himself and experience it and test it. Now, that can't, of course, that's a dangerous thing on the one hand. On the other hand, maybe just think of it as, like, I remember as even sort of my high school years as a young person, there's a lot of things that you've been told, right? There's a lot of things that you've just been, like, your parents just said it. Like, these are true principles about life. And I don't know about you, but there's a sense in which I'm like, okay, I appreciate that. I even believe it. Like, I understand it. But there's a part of me that wants to see for myself. There's a part of me that wants to just not take what everyone has said to me and just almost blindly believe it. I want to investigate. I want to be able to say these things myself. Again, you got to be careful how far you go down that path. And I don't know how careful Solomon was per se, because he went to an extreme. Maybe another illustration aside from like a young person kind of investigating would be like, if you have a doctor that allows himself intentionally to get a disease, to like monitor it and examine it and see what happens. And he knows, I mean, it's not going to kill him, but he wants to see how it works. And so he's just sort of examining this entire process with wisdom, right? He's not like, I'm not being stupid, guys. I know what's going on, but I want to investigate. I want to know for myself. And so that's sort of the journey that he sets out on, is to see his, what he's ultimately looking for is this, to see what's good for the children of men to do under heaven. So we don't have many years here. So is there something that we can do that will give us a profit on our investment? So how does he do that? This is verses 4-8. He made great works. He built, he made himself things. He made himself other things. He bought, he had, he gathered, he got, right? All of these things. He planted, just all of this. He's just gathering, accumulating, buying, assembling. And what is he assembling? Okay, he's assembling great works. He built houses and planted vineyards. He made gardens and parks and in them all kinds of fruit trees. He made pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks. More than any who were before me in Jerusalem, I gathered silver, gold, treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of men. So he is just like jumping all in. If I'm going to experiment, I'm going to experiment thoroughly, right? So he just goes all the way, nothing withheld. His heart found incredible pleasure, right? He built more than anyone before him. We'll see his conclusion in a second, but he built more than anyone before him. I'll make one comment on this here. Many concubines at the end. What other translations do we have of that here? Verse 8, right before the delight of the sons of man. After singers. Okay, we have musical instruments. That's different than concubines. You have instruments as well, right? Okay. Anything else? Okay. Other ones, I didn't know if we'd have them here, but a lot of others would say sort of like luxuries or treasures. The Septuagint has cupbearers. Essentially, we have no idea what this word means. It's two words. It's a feminine singular noun and then a feminine plural noun. And we have no clue. It's a hapax legomena, which means it's just used one time. And so this is everyone taking an educated guess and no one having any idea. So take your pick. I think we get the point because it's at the end of the list, which is sort of a big demonstration of exactly what Solomon's doing. But there's not necessarily a better option than another, I don't think. I think whatever it is, I think people probably choose instruments because it comes right after singers, and people would choose concubines because it comes right before the delight of the sons of men. So it's whatever you would like to insert, you can carefully and appropriately insert there. It's not, we don't know what that word is. But we still have this picture, right? And I want to go back to 1 Kings again. Let's go one chapter further than we went last time, 1 Kings chapter 4. Just as a little bit more of an illustration of what is going on here, how Solomon is living. This is the historical account, what Solomon's doing. We're going to start in verse 20 of 1 Kings chapter 4. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines. As far as the border of Egypt, they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now, Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 20 oxen from the pastures, and 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fatted fowl. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from Tifsa even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of the river. And he had peace on every side all around him. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. And these governors, each man in his month, provided food for King Solomon. And for all who came to King Solomon's table, there was no lack in their supply. They also brought barley and straw to the proper place for the horses and steeds, each man according to his charge. And God gave Solomon wisdom and exceedingly great understanding and largeness of heart like the sand on the seashore. Thus Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the men of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt, for he was wiser than all men, than Ethan the Ezrahite, and Heman and Chalcol and Darda, the sons of Mahal, and his fame was in all the surrounding nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. And he spoke of trees from the cedar tree of Lebanon, even to the hyssop that springs out of the wall. He spoke also of animals, of birds and creeping things, and of fish, and men of all nations from all the kings of all the earth who had heard of his wisdom came to hear the wisdom of Solomon. He was magnificent. He had and knew everything. He was the expert in all fields. He had it all put together. He was the wealthiest man. So you would think that he would get something out of that, that he would get something in return. But what is his conclusion? 9 through 11. So I became great, and I surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. This could, and this reference, this is Solomon writing, this could be a reference just to his father and Saul, or I was thinking this past week, Jerusalem was also an ancient city, right? He could just be referring to everyone that ever ruled Jerusalem before him. Even potentially, theoretically, back to, like, we talk about Melchizedek, the king of Salem, like, ancient, even before Solomon. Perhaps he's just referring to the city as a whole. Like, anyone that's ever sat here, I'm the greatest of them all, and my wisdom still is with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I said, yes, you can have it. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. Behold, all was vanity and a striving after the wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So, nothing was withheld. His heart did find something, okay? He kept his heart from no pleasure, for his heart found pleasure. So he got something. He's like, guys, it was fun. I enjoyed it. There were a lot of good times. In all of this abundance, in all of the parties, in all of my knowledge, and all of the kings and rulers all coming to me with their gifts, and all of these things I've accumulated, and even just establishing these beautiful gardens and forests and pools to water the forest, he's like, it was fun. And this was his reward for all his toil. Now, here is a key word that we have not gotten into yet that we need to right now, okay? So this is the word chelek. And I think reward is probably a poor translation, and they translate it different ways throughout here. I don't understand why. The idea here is that this was his portion. This was his lot in life. This is what God gave him. This was his piece of the pie, as it were. Okay? And what he received, his portion, was that he had some pleasure in the toil. That was what God gave him for all of this effort. Remember that for later, because that becomes a major theme, something that we'll look at time and time again. Well, it doesn't come up very often, but when it does, it's really important. So he got some pleasure in his toil. Let's read the next line again, and then we'll say this. So, but then he considered everything his hands had done and the toil he'd expended in doing it, all his investment. And again, it was vanity and striving after the wind. And he says, there was nothing to be gained. We have this back, we're back to, okay, programmatic question. Yitron, gain, what's the profit? He says nothing, okay? So how does this make sense? We had, unfortunately, a prime example of this happen in our world in this past week. And that was, as many of you probably know, Kobe Bryant and his daughter died in a helicopter crash. Now, Kobe Bryant is a legend. He equals basketball, right? Just like Michael Jordan or LeBron James equal basketball, Kobe Bryant, his name equals the game. He's one of the greatest, and many would argue the greatest of all time. And he had game after game, success after success. I think the high score that he scored in a game was 81 points, right? I mean, imagine that day, right? That's a great day, really high, a lot of pleasure, enjoying his success. But then you know what? The game ends, right? The whistle sounds, and now his life is gone. His life has ended. What did he take with him? What did he actually, in the end, get out of all of his investment into the game, all of his love for the game, all of his passion, his knowledge. I mean, he was a genius of the game. What did he get out of it? Ultimately, nothing. That is frustrating. He gave his life to it, and all he got was, you know, a good game. That felt good. It's almost, or imagine another example could be like someone who has just like created a fine piece of pottery, and they love, they invested into it. They enjoyed the process, and then, you know, they put it into the oven or the kiln or whatever it is, and they take it out. It's all finished and beautiful, and they set it down, and they turn around, and then they forget that it's there, and then they accidentally knock it over, and they break it. All of the pleasure and the joy is gone with the leaving of your investment. Right? When your investment ends up leaving, it's like the pleasure is gone as well. And ultimately, and we'll get to this more later again because it's a return to the theme. Ultimately, as much as people would retaliate against this thought, Kobe Bryant will be forgotten. Not this week. No, not this week. Not in the Lakers' first game back. Absolutely not. It's all about him. But in 10 games, 20 games, next year, 10 years, I mean, who were the top 10 gladiators in the Colosseum? I mean, you might know one or two, maybe. But like, who were the guys that you wanted with you, or who were the legends? I don't know. I think there's like a movie about one of them. You know, like that. We don't know. They've been forgotten. Maybe their names were etched at some point in some place, and it's been eroded. That's what will happen given time. To the legend of Kobe Bryant, too. That's vanity. That is frustrating. But he says, ultimately, then, there's nothing to be gained. There is no yatron. So it's like this rich, rich man, right? He smelled it all. He's tasted it all. He heard it all. He saw it all. He felt it all. And yet, after all of it, it's empty. It was fun. I loved it. The party was great, but it's gone. After all the wine and all the booze, there's still a hangover. After all the party, you still gotta, the weekend's over, you know? It all comes to an end. So the danger is that those who chase pleasure often conclude not that pleasure doesn't deliver or that there's no profit in it, but only that they haven't experimented enough or they haven't had enough pleasure or the right kind of pleasure. And so they keep going. They keep chasing it until you get to the end and you realize it actually did nothing. One illustration perhaps of this, we'll see if we get through all of this. I'm not positive. We have 15 minutes. I was listening to the radio this week and there was a caller that called in and he posed a question. Essentially, he had a job that paid him $100,000 a year and he hated it. And there was another job offer that would pay him $50,000 a year that he really thought that he would enjoy. Should he do it? Should he exchange more money for more pleasure? It was really interesting, right, to listen to all the comments. And of course, there's a ton of variables. You have people calling in and saying, dude, suck it up. Like, you're doubling your income, so work with it. You have other people saying, get out. Because there's no price tag on your happiness, right? And yeah, go ahead. And there's, and exactly what you said, that whatever you experienced, I don't know your story, but what happened was hevel. Like you probably shouldn't have lost it all, right? Like that's frustrating. That doesn't make sense. It was, but it's an evidence. It's actually an evidence of two things. One, of your father's legacy and one of Hevel. Because later on, we'll get to Solomon essentially saying, putting himself in the position of the father, because it's Hevel for the dad too. It's Hevel for everyone, right? Okay, so we have this illustration, right? 100,000 or 50,000. So what's better? Essentially, switch the illustration around and say you have a $50,000 job that you do enjoy, and you have the opportunity to go to a $100,000 job that you know you won't. Would you do that? Essentially, what you're asking is a bigger piece of the pie worth a stomach ache the whole time? Because, you know, all of us have it in us. All of us have it in us where we're like, when there's two pieces of pie left and one's bigger, which one do you want? You want the bigger one. And maybe that's okay to an extent, right? But what the whole point of this that he'll get to is he's saying, be content with whatever piece of the pie God gave you. Stop trying to get a bigger piece, because a bigger piece doesn't do you any good. Ultimately, contentment does you good, right? And so if I build more, if I drink more, if I taste more, if I try more, if I gather more, if I buy more, what do I profit? Some pleasure, but nothing else. There you go. Yep. And that's part of living with wisdom in a broken world. And he gets that especially in the second half of the book. Okay, we're going to keep going. So we have the first experiment was joy or pleasure, right? The second one now is wisdom. And so you'll see kind of the contrast again. We highlighted some of the wisdom elements before. If you want to highlight where wisdom is in this text, you can. So let's look at verses 12 through middle of 14. So I turned to consider wisdom. Transition, new topic. Now I'm just thinking about wisdom and madness and folly. What's right or wrong? How wise can I be? For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. All right, he's saying, all right, I'm doing the ultimate experiment, guys. Like, if anyone can do it, it's me. So what's the guy that comes after me going to do? The same thing that I just did. Listen to my conclusion. I'm the master in this topic. Hear me. I've been given wisdom from God, okay? And he says, then I saw that there is more yitron. There is more gain in what? In wisdom than in folly. As there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. So there is something good. There is profit. There is gain. It's almost like, is he changing his mind? Because he's like, look, guys, at the end of the day, wisdom is better. Just like light is better than darkness. Why do we even have the lights on right now? We could just shut them all off. Why do we even have electricity? Let's just because it's better. Because we can see where we're going. We can see what we're doing. Our shins are thankful. Our toes are thankful. Right? That we have electricity. And if you put this in a spiritual sense, is it better to live with light or darkness? Well, light, absolutely. Because you're going to avoid a whole bunch of headache and heartache. You're going to live a life that's more enjoyable. But at the end of the... So it is better. There is profit. You profit more, perhaps, comfort or enjoyment or anything you enjoy with the lights on, right? That you couldn't enjoy with the lights off. That's all better about living with wisdom, because it's illuminating. It gives you light on the path of a dark world. So that's cool. That's good. Wisdom helps you see. You can see right and wrong and how to negotiate life with all of its challenges. Fools are blind and have no idea how to live and hence make a mess of their lives, right? So yeah, better to live with wisdom. It has practical utility. Just like light has practical utility. Still doesn't answer the big questions, but it's better. Carry on though in verse 14. And yet I perceived, which is that word for know, that's knowledge again, and yet I know. Something kind of disappointing. The same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is Hevel. For of the wise as of the fool, there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come, all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after the wind. It's like, okay, yeah, I get it. It's better to not live in darkness. It's better to not be a fool, to squander all my money, to become addicted to all these things, to have no family relationships, to just be burning relational bridges behind me everywhere I go. Yeah, it's better not to, but at the end of the day, we both are dead. The wise guy's dead, the fool's dead. Nobody remembers the wise guy, nobody remembers the fool. So he hated life. This is like the cry of a child who just realized that life is not fair. That's not right. That's not fair. That does not make sense. But you know what? I think we cry the same thing in our hearts, but just as adults, we stifle it. We've learned to stifle the life's not fair, and instead we chuckle about it and pat our kids on the head and say, yeah, life's not fair. But that's frustrating. That doesn't seem right. And so that's why I think his blunt statement kind of makes us uncomfortable. But what he's saying is that death and the frail character of life are evil. That's not right. And the man who can realize that and see that is wise. To realize death as a great evil is wisdom. The fool disregards that. It doesn't answer the big questions, but it illuminates life. Because we actually are going to try and make it through this. We're going to keep going. So experiment number three, right? Toil, work. And he's already investigated a little bit. We've already talked about it a little bit. But because of what he just concluded, he says in verse 18, I hated all my toil, in which I toil under the sun. Why? Seeing that I must leave it to a man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool. Yet he will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity. So I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun. Because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill, all these great things, he has to leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. This also is vanity and a great evil. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow and his work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. Okay, so he's not happy, right? Problem number one, I don't know who's going to inherit everything that I amassed. That doesn't seem right or fair. Two, I can't control what they're going to do with it. Once I die, I lose my say in life under the sun. My voice doesn't matter anymore because people are continuing the cycle and mine's out. Okay. Later on, he says, it's a live something than a dead lion, right? Like the lion's better. The lion's more powerful, but it's dead. So it doesn't matter. You lose your voice, you lose your influence. It's also a problem that someone who did absolutely nothing gets all of my stuff. So the profit itself, everything you gained, right? You could look at this and say, well, he did amass a lot. There's a lot there, but it's Hevel because it's elusive. It's Hevel because he has to leave it. So there's this despair in labor because someone who toils even with wisdom and with knowledge and with skill must leave his chelek. Right? His portion. Same word. As this. His reward was pleasure. And now he has to give up his entire piece of the pie to somebody else. That's vanity and a great evil. That problem, honestly, is only exacerbated by people who do work wisely and work well. People who, you know, at the end of their life have nothing. It's not like they're not trying to pass on a lot. They don't have a lot materially to lose. And then he concludes, he says, well, he restates the programmatic question, right? What has a man from all the toil and striving of his heart in which he toils beneath the sun? Restatement of chapter 1, verse 3. Because that person, his days are full of sorrow. His work is a vexation. Even in the night, his heart does not rest. You know, work is hard and the results are uncertain. Success is empty because death ends it all and removes a man from power, both to enjoy and to control. The man who makes this his concern finds no solution. His days are sorrow, his work is vexation, and his night are restless. Wanted to conclude because there's great, well, sort of interesting, profitable, helpful resolution. But there might be too much to go because there's some difficult things we have to work through in this last section. So let's summarize. Maybe we'll go for 5 more minutes. We'll be able to wrap it a little bit. Put a small bow on it anyways. This is his conclusion. There's nothing better than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. We're going to revisit this because there's 5 of these passages in Ecclesiastes. That's why I feel okay starting it and not really fully finishing it, because we will fully finish it later. This is how to best cope with a life which is God-given, but fraught with mystery, such as the fact that a man's limited knowledge and ability to comprehend leave him without answers. Answers that we desperately want. So, this is good, nice, positive advice. He says, okay, eat and drink and enjoy life. But how? Because on the one hand, you want me to recognize that God has cursed and judged humanity, making something that was once straight crooked and making the pursuits of men for more than they have been given fruitless and frustrating. So we just acknowledge that. And now on the other hand, you want me to just eat, drink, and be merry. Really? This is an unhappy, he just said earlier in chapter 1, verse 13, this is an unhappy business that God has given the children of man to be busy with. And now you want me to enjoy this unhappy business? Yes. There's another theme of Kohelet is God himself. All things are in God's hands. All things are ordered by God. Jerry, we talked about this a little bit at the end of last week, and I think one reason he's not as evangelistic as he could be is because God is inescapable. Whatever approach you take, whatever wisdom you neglect or embrace, you can't escape God. He is there. So Kohelet assumes his presence. The vanity of life is the judgment of God on a rebellious race. But here, God makes it clear that the hand of God is at work for blessing as well. Any ability that you have to smile, to enjoy, to eat a good meal, to drink, to find enjoyment in your work, anything, any time that happens to you, that was a good gift from the generous hand of God. There is a sense in which that's true, because he's still frustrated that he doesn't have answers to the questions he wants answered. So in that sense, yes. But then at the end of the day, it's not just one man frustrated that he couldn't find the answers. His conclusion is, it's impossible for you to find the answers. You're not supposed to have these answers to this question he's asking. So he says, because you're not allowed to know, this is best. So it's better compared to what he wants, but at the end of the day, it's actually best according to what God wants us to do. There's a lot more to unpack here, including some distinctions in different translations and what he's talking about with the one who pleases him gets knowledge and joy, but the sinner gets gathering and collecting, and what does that mean? We'll finish this up and put a bow on it next week. But think of the analogy of the piece of pie as we conclude, okay? God's given you a portion, a chelek. He's given you something to enjoy. And any opportunity you have to enjoy it is his gracious gift. If you look back in the garden, what was man in his perfection intended to do? Eat, drink, and enjoy his labor. That's what God was, what he made us for. And to enjoy God's gifts. And that's what we'll be doing for eternity. So this is not, I mean, it's not just saying, well, I mean, you got some food, right? Eat it. Like, I may as well enjoy the burger. No, he's saying, like, this is actually a taste of eternity. These are gifts of God. These are foreshadowing of what you will be doing forever. Forever you will eat and drink and find enjoyment in your toil. And that is a good gift from the hand of God. So do it now as he allows. Stop trying to get a bigger piece of the pie. Be content. Let's pray.